Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Penchassi. My guest today is Alexia Yates, the author of Selling Paris, Property and Commercial Culture in the Fin de Siècle Capital. And the book was published by Harvard University Press in 2015. Hi there, Alexia.
Hi.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
I'm very happy to have the opportunity.
Would you get us started by telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and what got you interested in working on France?
Of course. So I began, my undergraduate studies not at all as a historian of France. I did an honors thesis on the English Civil War. I was a scholar, if that's what we can call honors theses at the undergraduate level of early modern Britain. But I did my studies in the U.S. and studies students in the U.S. often have the opportunity to go abroad for a year. Now, I did not go to France. I went to Ireland, but I had the opportunity to this was the first time I took a 19th century European history course at Trinity College in Dublin. And it happened to be taught by, a scholar whose work I later became very familiar with, James Lidicey. And he taught this course as France and the birth of modernity in the modern world. I was sort of completely swept away. This was cemented when I returned to finish my degree with a class by John Monroe, who was finishing up his degree at the time at Yale, and he was hired by my college to come, sort of teach a course. We didn't have anyone teaching French history at my college. And he taught a year-long course on Paris as capital of the 19th century. And so I had to tell my undergraduate supervisor that while I would, complete my honors degree in early modern British history, I was won over to France. Mm-hmm. And it was really, a coup de cœur. I just really enjoyed these particular classes, and that set me on the road.
Well, and it sounds like you got interested in France through this work on or learning about 19th century Paris. So I see where the book comes from in that way. But how did you get interested and set on the road to working on real estate and property mm-hmm. and commercial culture?
Part of that is, part of it was pragmatic, part of it was fortuitous. Certainly, I did my MA at the University of Toronto, and I worked on youth culture in Paris. Mm. So I fully intended to do, my PhD on youth culture with a strong spatial component, studying ways that young people tried to find and create spaces for themselves in the modern city. But, as much as I began with a very urban focus, though not specifically a property focus, I have to say that Paris is not a city that lacks for chroniclers. Mm-hmm. There was a degree to which I was looking for a new approach to a space that has been at the core of most broadly French history, but also of cultural studies, of urban studies. And I was hoping to find, and I think eventually I did find, in the study of its property dynamics, an approach to urban culture that didn't neglect the culture part, but that sort of upped the ante on the social history part. And the fortuitous, or perhaps fortuitous is not the right word, but the more circumstantial element, I would say, of looking for a dissertation topic is that while I began my research in 2005, a lot of the substantive writing and sort of, really critical engagement with my sources once my archival trips were done, that was between 2007 and 2010. So this is the height of the financial crisis. Mm. This was seeing Alan Greenspan on television talking about what the nature of a national property market is, or in his argument is not. I think I could have imagined a world in which looking at property dynamics would sort of intellectually make a lot of sense, and could have been arrived at through a variety of routes. But imagining a world in which the mortgage suddenly became a topic of everyday conversation, I think that was something that, I didn't predict.
Right.
And certainly it shaped the form that the book took, it shaped the kinds of questions that I was asking of it, that people were asking me of it. Mm-hmm. So very much, I think, the circumstances in which it was composed shaped, how it was composed. And I think there's evidence in the book that I did at the time, and I continue, I think, with my new research to sort of to work hard and not necessarily resolve this sort of problem of presentism that is in the book still, I think. And I think it comes from that particular sort of nascent moment in a moment when, you know, it seemed like real estate was defining sort of our globalized financial world. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, situating that historically continues to be, you know, a really important task.
So, you know, I had one of these kind of wonderful experiences that I sometimes do when I read these books for the podcast where, you know, I think I know a little bit about the urban history of Paris in the 19th century. I lecture on Haussmannization. And, you know, when I started reading the book, I had that experience of thinking, oh, right. How come I've never really thought about this or read about this before? So I guess that's one of the first questions I wanted to ask you. We think we know about Paris in the 19th century because of what we know about the urban history through the history of Haussmannization. But the book sort of is really starting in the early years of the Third Republic. So there's that chronological shift. But it's also a response to the approach of those mm-hmm. scholars and studies of the urban history of the capital in the 19th century focused on Haussmannization. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, and again, you know, the distinction between a dissertation and a book, you know, when I was writing this dissertation, I, you know, was trying as hard as I could to ignore Haussmann. you know, saying, you know, I'm going to stake my claims somewhere else. Right. We don't need to think more about Haussmann at this moment. And I hope that I managed to bring him in more in the finished version of the book, because, of course, he is inescapable, and the particular property regime, the sort of public-private regime development that he establishes under the direction of and coordination with Napoleon III and the Second Empire, thanks to some other strands of historiography, I wouldn't say historiography of scholarship, you know, of sort of historical geography, and here I'm thinking primarily of David Harvey, mm-hmm. Haussmann stays, again, really prominent in our understanding of sort of development regimes, what other scholars of the city have called growth machines. But there's a real jump in some of this scholarship, sort of a really historically insensitive jump from Haussmann to the present, you know, which completely overlooks all of the permutations of urban development grappling with the problem of urban growth that occur, obviously, not only in Paris in between, but in many different urban mm-hmm. centers between the mid-19th century and the present. So I did distinctly think that, you know, there's something that we need to learn from how people try to reconstitute their city in the aftermath of the kind of revolution that he constituted.
You make the point in the introduction, Alexia, that, you know, you're interested, and I'm quoting you here, in the fundamental reconfigurations in the relations between finance, commerce, and real estate that occurred at the end of the 19th century, and that now I'm sort of paraphrasing loosely, shaped both the built form and social experience of the modern metropolis. And you underline in the introduction, but then go on in the various chapters of the books to really explore the ways in which real estate is a social product. So can you explain a little bit what that phrase means for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mean it both in the ways that you just drew out there in terms of it, of its built form, and then the social experience of the environment. You know, I did want to, part of the contribution that the book is trying to make is also to, you know, a scholarship about the sociology and the anthropology of markets. It's looking at practices by which markets are, you know, made up, by which they're constituted, and through the actors through which markets are performed, the tools by which they're made. So when I wanted to talk about real estate as a social product, what I want to say is that, you know, it is not something that is out there, that is a pre-given, that is simply, you know, a lot of land which, owing to conditions of scarcity, will take on particular qualities given, you know, urban density, etc. But that it is, you know, a legal entity, that it, of course, is something that bears some deep cultural and political meaning, and that these various strains of its existence need to be constantly negotiated. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, sort of thinking about it as a thing. And then to connect it to this notion of a social experience, I also wanted to highlight that it is, you know, in this process of construction, something that is a terrain of contestation.
I just want to follow up on something you said then, and then maybe also linking back to what you described as the kind of context in which you were doing the research and writing mm-hmm. this book, and, well, the dissertation and then the book, that you know, it's hard to write about property and capitalism and cities without political and moral positions and judgments coming into play. And I guess I wonder about dealing with questions of distributions of wealth and inequity. And yeah, just if you could speak to how you negotiated that as a researcher and a writer wanting to explore and examine this landscape, but then also perhaps wanting to, I don't know, come down on the developers and speculators. And I mean, you don't really, you don't, the implication is there at moments. I mean, I was doing it as I was reading, but I just wonder about that for you as an author, what that was like.
Yeah, and I mean, and there are moments, and I'm glad that I find them too when I reread the book. You know, where you know I at least say, you know, there was an opportunity for here for the city to look more humane, and they didn't take it.
Right.
But those are a few sentences out of many, many pages.
Sure.
And I think that.
And I don't mean this as a judgment, just to be clear.
No, I understand, and I agree. And I've had obviously I've grappled with the question, but you know, and it's obviously it's also something of deep. It's only become of more contemporary significance. You know, with the publication of Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, he puts a tremendous amount of weight, and he has more in public discourse since then on the role of real estate in kind of intergenerational wealth transfers and the accumulation of wealth in housing as one of the most significant kind of barriers to social mobility that we currently have. You know, and it took me, you know, just to sort of to enter the confessional, it took me a really long time to recognize sort of the illicitness of what some of the, particularly my real estate agents, the developers is a little bit more obvious right from the beginning, but I think because I spent so much time trying to find these agents, real estate agents are not easy to find in the archives, and that whenever I did find them, I was like, so happy, and I just, you know, was devouring information I could find, and I was like, what kind of furniture did they own, etc. And sometimes you step back and I'd be like, well, I would just read a case of one of their bankruptcy files and I'd be like, oh, these are some shady guys.
Yeah.
you know, and you'd develop a real, you'd instantly kind of, your mind would go to a parallel situation today and you'd think, oh, you know, these people aren't worth your time. But of course they are.
Right. You make the point in the introduction, Alexia, that this is an urban history of business and a business history of a city. And I really like that formulation. I think it encapsulates the project here. We've talked about the urban history and how the book is a contribution to that field when it comes to 19th century Paris. So I guess I want to ask you about the business history side of it, the way in which you see the book as a contribution to, yeah, to the history of enterprise, to the history of French capitalism, liberalism, in a broad sense.
Yeah, the book broadened out as I was doing it as well, because I did very much start out committed to this as a specific type of business history, and this is why I think probably the people that I spent the most time on, you know, as I was just sort of outlining, would be, you know, trying to track down these particular agents, because we hadn't, you know, ever seen or heard much from them before. And they're important for a number of reasons, as you pointed out, not only in sort of the urban history aspect of sort of what it is they're doing to sort of build an understanding of the city as well as the actual spaces of the city, but the insights they can give us about, you know, what it was like to be a business person in late 19th century France, and where it is that this sort of story of speculation, of risk-taking, of, you know, as I've said, sometimes shady enterprise, fits in with our other stories of what sources of, to put it in this broadest terms, what the sources of the self were in 19th century French political culture. So the book does engage with, you know, I think, some of our most prominent you know, historians on this topic, primarily Sarah Mazza, with her work on the earlier period about trying to find this sort of mythical French bourgeoisie.
Right.
And, you know, whether the bourgeoisie exists or not in the period she's discussing, you know, what she really foregrounds is sort of problem of self-interest that I think does remain quite prominent French political culture throughout the 19th century. That doesn't seem to prevent people from becoming extremely successful businessmen, but it does prevent them from becoming celebrated in a way that I think we would see in some other primarily Anglo-Saxon contexts. So, you know, the book certainly is a further contribution to work, which I think since the 1970s, 1980s, has sort of overturned this notion that there's, the French have no word for entrepreneur, that it means a very specific thing. So it's a further contribution to that historiography. But at the same time, I think we have to acknowledge that capitalism at its broadest, business, and perhaps a more narrow sense, continued to occupy a very ambiguous place in public life. It was not your route to being celebrated as a member of, particularly a member of the Republic, despite the fact that, we know that the Third Republic was one that firmly embraced liberal economic norms. It remains quite ambiguous, but it is certainly different. I wouldn't want to say that, if you study these real estate speculators, you study these risk-taking individuals, and you see these people, someone like Paul Foucault, who's got this English masthead on the front of his development, because that, time is money. I'm not trying, that doesn't mean that the ethos of French business was exactly the same as everywhere else. It does mean that when you study business cultures and when you study possibly cultures of capitalism, we need to be very attentive to time, to place, and even to sector, right? Mm-hmm. That real estate might look like, might look like it does in the States, or it might not, but that doesn't mean that other industries do.
You just mentioned the architect and developer, Paul Foucault, and I guess I want to ask you, so there are architects, developers, a kind of broad question about who the book deals with, and each chapter is kind of focused on a different set of actors or agents, sometimes more than one, but really kind of there's a central one for each of the chapters. Who is the book about, and what archival materials, what are your sources in terms of accessing, you talk about hunting down these agents, so if you could give us a sense of the broad categories of actors and agents, not real estate agents, but historical agents in the book. And then, what source materials you were looking at and what sort of novel contributions you see the book making in terms of archives that we may not know as much about.
I think my book still needed more individual actors, but I do think I've got a lot in there. Because one of the key things it's trying to do, right? Of course, it's engaging with a very prominent scholarship about sort of how urban capitalism operates in the 19th century in France, in which normally in that scholarship the only actors are Napoleon III and Haussmann, right, or capital itself. So one of the goals of this book is to find a bunch of other people and sort of institutions that are involved. So we do have sort of these business-minded speculative architects, Albert Lobière, Paul Foucault, Henri Blondel, who come up, and far more anonymous ones who come up as well. It has intermediaries of various sorts, would be a good way of naming a whole other host of characters. So, the real estate agents, notaries as well. So, sort of these legal intermediaries who really bridge what you might call a more traditional world of commerce and sort of a more contemporary looking world of commerce. Property owners who appear in the forms of their interest groups are also key actors in the story. And I think that's sort of that, the people that own the property of the city have really not been considered in any active sense as engaged in urban development. And they certainly were. Tenants are also important. And here again, I'm successful at finding at least the names of some of them, if not much more, about what it is that they're doing in their buildings. But tenants are important actors, primarily because the book tries to follow a structure where it looks at how property acts as and is constructed as a commercial object. So it moves through this chain of production, distribution, and consumption. So at each of those points, it tries to find the people who are engaged in making property do that thing. A lot of the sources for this book are, I began as a business history, are business archives. France has got some excellent business archives. For anyone who wants to travel to Lille and to go to Roubaix to see the branch of the National Archives dedicated to the world of work, the people who would never have been you know, side by side in life are in this archive. You know, banks are next to labor organizations. Anything associated broadly with the world of work is at this particular archive, and they happen to have the sort of company reports, annual filings of real estate companies in particular for this project, but of many other sorts of enterprises as well. So that was one important source, and certainly where I started to sort of try to figure out, you know, what kind of documentation does exist about these particular companies, how much can I find? Oh, I mean, obviously I had quite a few printed sources because I deal a lot with advertising, advertising in the city, so that, you know, would have taken me to all of my lovely moments at the Bibliothèque Nationale. But I also, in trying to find these agents, had to be a little bit more creative. So I used bankruptcy files at the Paris archives quite a lot in order to try to get a sense of what the nature of their offices were. When an agent goes bankrupt, they do a survey of his goods. So sometimes even if the person has fled, you can get a sense of what sort of heirs he had about his business by the things he leaves behind. So those were quite important sources. I also found private business archives, and that required, you know, very much being on the spot in Paris and being willing to walk into agencies and try to set up appointments with people to see if any of the very few real estate agencies that are still in existence today, but which began in the 19th century, had anything they were willing to let you look at. So that meant, you know, as I said, turning up and sometimes being willing to turn up a few times. But more prominently, and this is sort of, I think, the thing I'm most proud of, the thing I found that I'm most proud of, you can find out about the current owners of any businesses in France by writing to the Tribunal de Commerce. They have to keep these documents on record, and you pay, I think at the time it was something like 12 euro, and you can get the sort of the filing, the most recent filing of that company, which has all the home addresses of the registered owners of the particular company you're interested in. So for some of these agencies, I found home addresses, and I, you know, rest assured, I did not go to anyone's home and present myself to look for archives. But I did, you know, find very appropriate, impressive looking stationery and pen, very formal letters to these individuals with, you know, references to people they could contact. And through that way, I was able to find some of my most interesting sort of private archives.
That's so really interesting.
Yeah, and professional associations as well. You know, I could go on and perhaps will as the conversation takes us there. But, you know, it has some hazards
sure.
working with contemporary associations who really do care about, you know, how their profession is depicted.
Yeah, no, I was curious about how the fact that the book has such an emphasis on private actors and interests translates into challenges archivally with access, but also with how you use the material that you're dealing with. In the first chapter of the book, Alexia, you deal with the building question in this period. And so I guess I want to ask you, what does that mean, the building question? And in particular, as you're exploring the significance of building to Paris and its history at the end of the 19th century, how is the story that you're telling a kind of after the watershed story, the watershed or sheds being or breaks being the Franco-Prussian War, the siege, Paris Commune, how is this book the exploration of a history in the wake of?
So the building question is, you know, it's not an actor's formulation. That's my formulation of, you know, how the city, in an effort to try to come to terms with it, by when I say the city, I mean here the municipal council, this newly created elected municipal council, which all of a sudden makes a kind of municipal politics in Paris that they haven't had for quite some time, is trying to come to terms with what it means to be a modern and very importantly, Republican municipal council in the aftermath of a kind of an imperial regime that was heavily characterized and, in fact, you know, to some degree scuttled by its urban politics. You know, towards the, I mean, one of the most destabilizing events at the end of the Second Empire is the way that house mobilization becomes sort of a target for this burgeoning solidified Republican opposition. So the building question is how I bring together many issues about which the municipal council has some jurisdiction and can debate and can attempt to work out what the proper role of, you know, the symbol called the capital T, capital C, the city, is in Republican sort of municipal context. And that's when they're trying to work out a question that, that really putters through all the chapters, which is sort of what is the proper role of public authority and what is proper to private interest? Mm-hmm. You know, where can those two align? Where don't they align? And each in a case-by-case basis, what is it that the city should be doing and what is it that private enterprise should be doing? So this is a chapter that sort of introduces some of the key actors in the book. It introduces how development happens. It introduces some of these big questions about where the city's responsibilities lie, both right. technically where they lie and then ideally where they should be, and particularly, you know, how do we make sure that whatever we do, however many streets we build, however much housing we provide or don't, that we don't look like the empire. We have to look like, we have to be Republican. Right. And that is just, you know, when it's, it doesn't even take, you know, a historian doesn't have to find that, that's just what they're saying.
Right. The second chapter of the book, Alexia, focuses on speculative builders as, you know, you term them purposive actors in urban land use decisions and their role as generators of common knowledge about how cities and markets should function. And the chapter is called, I love this chapter title, Seeing Like a Speculator. So I guess I want you to say why it's called that as a way of getting at the this kind of central argument of the chapter, but also how you're using or referring to James Scott's work on Seeing Like a State. So what role that plays in terms of your framework here, but then, yeah, what does it mean to see like a speculator as the historian writing about speculators in the 19th century in Paris?
Yes, and from another, you know, real estate agents are hard to find. Speculators are hard to find, too. And so, you know, part of the goal of this chapter is to recover this work that speculators were doing when they were, you know, building the city. So much of how we talk about it and how we talk about real estate speculation today is in these terms that really obfuscate agency, right? We talk about, you know, bubbles, and we talk about fevers, and we talk about... The term they use at the time, they use magic wands a lot. They will say, you know, like these magic wands are just bringing whole neighborhoods out of the ground. You know, one of the goals of this chapter is to be like, these are, as you said, purposive actors. These are people who are thinking quite hard about what they're doing. We might not like what they do at all, but there is, it's hardly magic. And so I wanted to, in uncovering that, I wanted to try to get at, you know, what it is. How does a speculator understand the environment in which they're working? What tools are at their disposal to try to discern how their developments, you know, sort of are whether they're likely to succeed or not? How do they decide to go in this neighborhood and not that neighborhood? And, you know, this brought me to, you know, so this notion of, you know, in a very kind of a lay way of sort of, you know, how do they see the city? And so I came to Scott actually via Mariana Valverde, who has an article called Seeing Like a City, which is actually about sort of the police authority in the urban environment. And, you know, in sort of working back in that direction, I realized that, you know, what I was taking from Scott in this title is looking for the counter tendencies that are part of the rationalizing impulse of both the state and of capitalism. So in looking at the tensions and the obstacles that that effort to achieve a holistic vision, in this case of the urban environment, obviously in other cases of broader territories, and a kind of perfectly abstract market environment encounter in the context of both a specific city and a specific type of commercial object, which here I'm talking about, you know, real property. So where are the tensions in that? And I began to look at speculators as people whose task was to manage that friction that kind of consistently exists between this dynamic of trying to make property something that was abstract and exchangeable, that a lot on this street and a lot on that street could do the same thing for you. And that is certainly the goal of the sort of financing mechanisms that are put in place in this period. But that is really never realized. It's not realized in the way they talk about the city. It's not realized in the way the city, if we can call it an actor for a moment, acts back upon their developments. It sort of brings a lot of their developments crashing down. So there is really this sort of consistent, you know, effort to render a perfectly rational and perfectly sort of abstracted market setting that is really consistently frustrated. I think if you look at if you take the right perspective on on the things that these people are both producing and the way they're talking about it.
You go on in the book, Alexia, to focus on individual proprietors. There's this kind of back and forth in the book between the individuals who own and then these groups of speculative builders and investment corporations who were newer on the scene. So could you talk a little bit about the interactions between those groups and give us a sense of what percentages of operators are there? So there's an image of the growing takeover of real estate by these investment corporations and larger entities. But what's the ratio here of individual proprietors to other types of agents and actors in the city when it comes to real estate?
And, you know, this is also a perfect opportunity to mention that I don't think I said, you know, property financing companies or insurance companies when I was cataloging my actors, but here they are.
There's so many of them. It's hard to list them all.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you've got an important tension in the book. Companies, in terms of the developer, in terms of developers, these new kinds of small-scale, limited liability joint stock companies that are kind of forming and disappearing within a span of months for speculative developments, those are quite substantially important in the field of development. In the field of ownership, Paris remains a city, and it will into the mid-20th century, that is primarily owned by individual proprietors. So the vast majority of, I believe, at the end of the 19th century, we've got something like, I'm going to get the number, it's around 80,000, I think it's slightly under 80,000 apartment buildings, residential structures, to say they're not all apartment buildings in the city of Paris. And, you know, the corporately owned buildings, such as I have been able to count them, you know, are in the neighborhood of about 3,000. That is a small number of the total buildings that, and this will, in the 20s, this will jump tremendously. And obviously today it's a very different picture, but they punch far above their quantitative weight. So these corporations might not own a vast proportion of the city, but the way that they preoccupy debate about property and the city, or the way that they dominate the debate and preoccupy policymakers, and preoccupy, for example, these individual proprietors themselves as a possible model for what their own associations can look like. The norms that they introduce in terms of how to manage a property, those are all sort of far more important than the actual numbers of properties that they end up buying up by, say, 1910. And the fact is that this is when that trend towards kind of a corporate city is beginning. It is in its early stages, but it's making a very pronounced appearance, and it's having distinct effects in how those who are in charge of governing the city think about what's possible in terms of housing. So numerically, they're definitely the new kid on the street, but they're really setting the terms for the discussion. And you do see that in the discussion of, one small way that I could use an example of that is thinking about how private property owners who are beginning to form associations for the first time in the 1870s. The big National Property Owner Association in France that we have today was founded in 1872 in the 11th arrondissement of Paris. And they are very much holding out the corporate property developer and the corporate property owner as a model for as a justification for property owners who are otherwise seen as being increasingly seen, I should say, because they, mid-century, this is not the case, but by this period are increasingly seen as inactive members of the national economy. They're people who sit on their land and don't do anything. The corporate property model will hold up for these owners it's a real argumentative point in their favor from their perspective for making the argument that they have a really important economic role to play in adding to the national economy. No one argues that these companies don't, so why shouldn't we also be seen as kind of gathering together and augmenting our property value for the sort of benefit of the national economy? So that's one way in which, they're making sort of a powerful impact on how property owners themselves are coming to understand what it is that they're doing in the city.
Mm-hmm. One of the sort of major contributions of your book, it seems to me, is this, and we've talked about this already, this idea of a diversity of actors that you're bringing to the story of the city and space and building and the built environment and the social experience of all this. And there are these great moments. And in this chapter, in chapter three, there's this moment where you used an example. I had a real sense of the way that the private and the public are imbricated and intertwined and in conflict in the city when you talk about the private roadways. So if you could say a little bit about that, I think it would sort of illuminate your approach here for listeners.
And, you know, and I think it's also one of the ways that changes how people walk around the city.
Mm-hmm.
That and the fact that, you know, speculators often wrote their names on the sides of buildings. But I've had people as well tell me that, you know, oh, you know, my brother lives on voie privée and I never really thought about it. And so it does, it makes you notice these little, and you start to notice what the terms like an impasse means or a villa, you know, that these have specific histories. And so the private roadways, you know, were something that, again, is, it's a fairly surprising thing to discover. It's great to exploit as these sort of, this is, you know, about the end of the 19th century in Paris, there's about 1,500 streets which are classified technically as private, right? So they're outside the public domain of the city. The city doesn't get to, but pretty soon they will, but at this period, they don't get to regulate what building looks like on these streets, what amenities are on these streets.
Mm-hmm.
So they are these sort of interstitial spaces. And it's surprising to think of, you know, the city that Haussmann is supposed to have made by 1870 having all of these spaces and having these spaces continue to grow, because in fact they are the core of how a lot of private development gets made. You open an access road on a larger lot. That's how your workers get in and out of a lot. You build houses, and then that road stays behind. And if you don't open it to public circulation, it remains a private street. And really, you know, until laws will successively limit this, but you are, as a property owner, you're really on your own home turf and with that kind of property. And I had that great quote, one of the famous Lazar brothers, who are these urban chroniclers of the 19th century, who, you know, try, and they particularly chronicle the poor quartier of Paris, where they refer to these streets as hermaphroditic streets. That they're streets that, you know, formally they haven't been turned over to the city, but obviously they're quite often physically open, so members of the public use them, but they are technically private. And you know, the city of Paris will spend some time and successfully, actually legislation passed at the national level, will successfully sort of do away with these legal gray zones. So I use them as a space to sort of signal both the physical and the juridical room for maneuver available to private property owners at the end of the 19th century.
I have to ask you, Alexia, and I know this is not at all the focus of the book, but this is really a book about men. Yeah?
Yes.
And that, again, it's not a judgment.
Maybe a judgment. It's a judgment I pass on myself. And you know, my current research is trying to somewhat go some lengths towards fixing this. But there are a few places where this does not, quote unquote, need to be about women particularly. There weren't very many women, say, real estate agents. There were a few. There weren't very many. Property owners is now one of those places. Female property owners were hugely significant in the city of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
They own a tremendous amount of property. And I think they were not represented at all in property owner associations that I studied. Towards, very much towards the very end of the period, I believe the core association, City of Paris, you know, has one issue of its paper where it discusses how a woman participated. And obviously, you know, women participated at all their festive occasions. Mm-hmm. But I think addressing that more critically absolutely should have been something that was in the book.
I wonder, too, if part of the project here is about the representation of property and real estate and the city. I mean, I guess from other work on Paris, especially, but just the city in general, the idea of, I mean, not just women's participation in all this, which is one issue, but also just the idea of gendered and sexualized metaphors for like property exchange, for real estate.
In the, you know, in the advertising for suburban properties, the advertising is overtly gendered. And again, I pass over this fairly quickly, but I do discuss a little bit the presentation of sort of the nuclear family that is often at the center of these sort of lavish posters advertising suburban developments. I include one image in the book in which a poster for a suburban development in which essentially you just see a very well-dressed woman. And I've used that image in presentations, using it to compare to contemporary advertisings for condominiums, which will often just have, you know, sort of, a very, you know, an incredibly well-dressed, obviously urban woman who is enjoying a cosmopolitan lifestyle. It's in that sense, they're incredibly parallel. And this, you know, woman's body is able to stand in for sort of refined lifestyle, for good taste, for, I would say, because in this particular image, she's shown as a single woman with all the sort of accoutrements of someone who is, very attentive to accessories of her class, that part of her ability sort of to stand in, I mean, she's obviously standing in for a kind of competitive and conspicuous consumerism, and possibly even sort of the convenience of this particular suburban development, which is, you know, close to the city of Paris, but allows you a little bit of escape. But that's also, in general, the most evocative of the property advertising are these suburban development posters. They're the richest. They're the ones that are filled with the most kind of symbology of all kinds. I would say one other place where, again, some of the earlier part of the century, I do have one of these quotes in there, discussions of how people, you know, sort of in visiting apartments and trying to find a new apartment, you're really violating this domestic sanctum. Mm-hmm. Some of that discussion, there's, you know, one particular example from, I think, a really popular urban physiognomy from 1840, where they discuss apartment hunting. They discuss all these signs popping out at you like courtesans, that they are sort of, you know, like hawking their wares in the streets. And I think those same kinds of worries, you know, later when I was saying, this is one of the places where, and this isn't about gendered imagery, but where women do come back into the story in terms of the subletting of apartments, you know, at the, sort of at the end of the story, I think some of the anxiety that sometimes surrounded discussions of boarding and letting, of letting people into particularly middle-class homes, was around this idea of sort of commercializing what should be domestic and private, and I think is sort of implicitly sexualized in that way, that there's a notion that strangers are coming and going from these rooms, often rooms that are let by women. Now, we're talking about a price point that is rather high, but I think, you know, some of that same kind of concern about an illicit traffic in the home is a, you know, sort of a different way that it is gendered, but I could have done a lot more with that in the book.
I mean, we've already talked, Alexia, about figure of the real estate agent, and, you know, you do have a whole chapter where you talk about their professionalization and their sort of entrepreneurial identity and, you know, other professions, lawyers, notaries, efforts to regulate the field in the period. And then you go on to talk about press and advertising, which we've touched on already. But I do want to come back to this representation of the apartment hunt that is, you know, the burden that this new profession and its attendant press and advertising machine will resolve for the 19th century consumer. But thinking about my own experiences, trying to find places to stay in Paris, I thought, oh, this whole dilemma has this history that now somehow has ended us up with, I don't know, Airbnb and internet sites where you look at multiple photographs of apartments. So I guess I just wanted to ask you to say more about the role that apartment hunting plays as a kind of cultural, social, economic object that you're exploring in this part of the book.
I mean, the hunt lets me do a few things. I mean, what's interesting is I was going to ask you, you know, I mean, has your search for an apartment, have you now decided that you should just turn to an agent and have someone do this for you? Like, most of us don't do that. And a lot of people in the past didn't do that either. In France, this particular, if you've ever watched any of the contemporary real estate shows in France, which you might imagine I do quite often, this new profession of the people who will seek an apartment for you, chasseur d'appartement, it's quite new. And it's one of these great ways of sort of thinking about, and so it gets to some of the broader, I hope, you know, contributions of the book, with thinking about this sort of uneven modernity, right? These people try to create a new need for their profession, and to a certain extent they succeed. But it's not a constant story of, and now this is why real estate looks the way it does today, right? Because there's moments it goes away and it comes back, and things get reinvented consistently. So now there's this impression that one of the really interesting things about the French real estate market, or sorry, I should say the Parisian real estate market, is that until very, very recently, you know, Asians had a really hard time getting a foothold in there. You know, the biggest real estate exchange site in France is Particulier à Particulier. Mm-hmm. You know, all of us as scholars have looked at it and been like, oh, we're not French. How can we? And we don't have a deposit. We don't have these forms.
God, I've forgotten about that.
That's from person to person, right? That is, agent didn't intervene. It remained very individualized. And agents have had a really hard time trying to convince people that they have something special to offer in this particular market. Mm-hmm. But they do try to do that when they start coming about and they're trying to both compete with notaries, who are the people who are most involved in property sales. The rental market is kind of wide open for them to maneuver in. And they're also trying to convince, you know, home seekers that they have something of value to contribute to this. And they play up the illegibility of the city. They sometimes play up the danger of the city. They certainly discuss sort of just the over and over the metaphor of, you know, how annoying it is to climb stairs. And to deal with the annoying concierge, and to have to maybe tip the concierge if you want to see the apartment, and have someone else can really, you know, they can do this all for you, or they can at least, you know, make you appointments and ensure that it all goes very smoothly. And in the process, they develop, you know, just like speculators did, a whole range of tools that people can use in order to try to facilitate something they might otherwise do, or begin to think about a move they may not have thought about without them. And that is, you know, this whole new kind of property marketing press that really explodes at the end of the 19th century, and that also innovates in its forms, you know, developing sort of new representations of domestic space in order to convince people that whatever they desire is just, it's out there. They just haven't found it yet. It's just behind this facade. And if you trust me, I'll get it for you. You know, this really, this discussion of things that are hidden in plain sight that they really exploit quite dramatically. And of course, they're helped in that by various kinds of both 1848 and 1871 insurrections that I think really do jar people's relationship to the urban environment, that really unsettle what were previously understood sort of appreciations of how the city works. And so that's something that again, they're able to exploit.
In the sixth chapter of the book, Alexia, you look at districts of the future, and it's another kind of provocative chapter title. So I guess I want to ask what the districts or these, you know, areas are that you're talking about here. And then also kind of more broadly, going back to something you said earlier about following property from building all the way up to use by individuals in neighborhoods, placement, that kind of stuff in context. Here, also kind of thinking about the story that you're telling as one that has, you know, an end in terms of how spaces are exchanged and then used, and the social spaces that are produced by these structures, the inadvertent and intentional, as you say, social spaces produced by these structures, but then also how all of this looks ahead or projects a kind of vision of the future of the city, a future of building in more specific ways, but then a broader future of Paris from the perspective of real estate.
Yeah, and in this case, districts of the future is a term from the actors. Mm-hmm. So this was something that came from how one of the two corporate property owners that I look at in this chapter, this is the Compagnie Foncière de France, and the other company is the Rente Foncière, but this term comes from the Compagnie Foncière de France and the classification that they adopt for their property portfolio. So this is one of the instances in which, and something that I think I have either fortunately or unfortunately become obsessed with, which is trying to make really boring things say interesting things. So their annual reports to their shareholders, which are not always the most interesting documents to read, they are, in times of crisis, a little bit more interesting. And one of the things that I tried to study was how they represented their properties to the shareholders to whom they are responsible. So this is a company that by the 1890s owns 167 buildings. The Rente Foncière owns about 200 more. Mm-hmm. And they design a particular sort of classification system for the types of buildings that they own and the geographic districts in which they're located. And the districts of the future are the way that they describe the west end of the city. And these are particularly areas that have been heavily built up in a speculative bubble in the 1880s, and, you know, whose sort of ritzy, very refined futures still lie maybe a decade and a half ahead of them. So these are areas that insurance companies will come into and build up pretty quickly. But at this point, these corporate buildings are still some of the only really substantial buildings out there. Hmm. And so what I did in this chapter was, this is where I try to say, I actually also want to give some space to the apartment buildings themselves as another one of these actors in the story. This is a type of architecture that's been overlooked. It was not rated at all by contemporary critics. It's often overlooked by historians. And yet, you know, these are the invisible buildings that we're not supposed to look at because we're staring at, you know, the icon that Haussmann has placed at the end of a street, right? So, but I wanted us to look at them. And so, you know, again, to refer to sources, I use these decennial tax surveys to kind of follow tax surveyors inside these apartment buildings, to walk with them up and down the stairwells, through the courtyards, into the individual apartments, and then to get a sense to the degree that I can from these sources of how those buildings were used. I didn't find tenants where I wanted to find them. I have all the reports of these companies. I don't have any of their correspondence with tenants. And that is sort of what I really wanted to find. And I haven't found it, despite writing to the homes of various kind of corporate contemporary owners. The current owner of the Compagnie Foncière de France is a Spanish multinational. But what I can tell from these surveys is the degree to which the companies placed managers throughout their buildings, how they adapted these spaces to suit specific market circumstances, as well as the needs of some tenants, and then how tenants themselves, I can only presume, given, as I said, the density of these kind of agents in the buildings, with the knowledge of the company, begin to transform the spaces as well. And so this is the space in which I talk about discovering that this was really a very thoroughly commercialized space, insofar as I found many, many individual tenants who had begun the process of renting out parts of their own apartments in order possibly to pay what were the very high rents of these districts of the future. So, I mean, there's something to talk about the future. I did recently reflect a little bit on, you know, how this is and isn't like Airbnb, in that, you know, these are people who are renting out parts of their own apartment. We can track them because they get taxed for that in the 19th century. So we can track at least the people who declare it. And, you know, this is a very middle class, upper middle class district. These are people who are paying 800, 1200 francs in rent. So, you know, presumably, you know, there's other ways that they could find money if they needed to. They could rent a cheaper apartment as possible. And you can try, you can see that, you know, sometimes the activity it picks up during the expositions, which are nearby to these houses. So you do see a certain amount of, you know, oh, there's going to be tourists in town. Perhaps I'll rent out part of my flat. And I suppose the parallel that I drew most directly was that, you know, in some of these buildings, when you see this practice, it becomes very spatially concentrated. Other neighbors learn it from neighbors. They begin to do it too. And in a few of these cases, entire apartment buildings became hotels. So, you know, if I were to hazard a lesson for today, I would say that this practice does seem to sort of permanently remove rental housing for long-term tenants.
I mean, I have to say, Alexia, like, I live in Vancouver, and reading your book was so fascinating to me. In the epilogue to the book, you look ahead to the First World War and its impact on the commercialization of property. So what did the war change? What sort of continuities are there from the period that you're looking at after mm-hmm. World War One?
Yeah, well, what we see happen in the wars, as I said, so in each of these chapters, we're really seeing this effort to examine this boundary between, you know, what is the market, what is commercial, what is business, and what is something else, either, you know, social or civil. And you know, and that continues in this period. And this is, you know, why I call the epilogue sort of impossible markets. But one of the things that happens, you know, with the experience of the war is obviously, you know, a story that many people are familiar with. It happened during the commune as well. We get moratoriums on rents. And this is, you know, to support those who are fighting at the front and who would otherwise lose an apartment when they left the city. And I think, as we know in Tyler Stovall's work on you sort of 1919 and consumer struggles in Paris, the rent moratorium gets what sort of initially becomes a practice like a social provision gets really quickly inscribed into this discourse of consumer rights. And then importantly, in 1919, you get a law that's instituted against illicit speculation in rents. And this is similar to other kinds of laws that characterize the war years in terms of punishing people who were gaining illicit profits on very basic necessities, hoarding goods and trying to sort of profiteer during the war, as they're worried that rent moratoriums are about to end,
right.
And they won't end, but they're afraid, you know, they might. They institute this law. And this, again, has this, you know, this contradictory effect. You know, lawyers begin to debate, can we even call rent is civil, it's not commercial. Can you speculate in something that's civil? This is the big divide that tracks through the whole book between what it is that sits outside the market in the civil realm and what it is that sits in it in the commercial realm. And so, again, in this contradictory way, to be able to charge someone with illicitly speculating in rent, you have to think about apartments as a merchandise. You have to make them like sugar or coffee. Mm-hmm. And you know, sort of the state here needs to sort of make a market in order to regulate it. And I think that's, you know, something that continues into the interwar period, you know, because nothing about, and this is sort of, you know, part of the reason the book ends where it does, is that nothing about the property market looks the same after the war. Yeah. And, you know, we get a lot of interesting innovations. You know, we'll begin for the first time, for instance, to begin to get condominiums. One of the things that people are often most surprised about reading the book is realizing that all of these apartments that you've read about in all these French novels are actually just rented. And then no one owns them. You know, Madame Bovary is renting her place. But that'll begin to change simply because people need to be able to find money to begin to build some more buildings again. And of course, I have to talk about this period because it's when we get the most long-lasting real estate agents association as well. So as they are beginning to get, you know, sort of accused in a very direct way of colluding with property owners in order to drive up rents, in order to hoard this new merchandise, which is this precious housing, real estate agents will form in 1921 a new professional association in order to sort of mm-hmm. really take a stand and to attempt to continue this longstanding effort they've had to sort of moralize their profession and to really develop sort of a commercial personhood that is understood as honorable and professional rather than venal. So those dynamics will, again, those will have long-standing effects as well. I mean, we still have that association will, after the Second World War, become FNAIM, which is the current National Association for Real Estate Agents in France. And it is directly out of those sort of wartime dynamics that's born.
Well, Alexia, there are loads of other questions I'd like to ask you, but I'm just going to ask you one more, which is, what are you working on now?
So I'm continuing, my interest in, you know, the institutions that shape economic practice and this, the stuff really that constitutes economic life. And part of what I love about this book is sort of my effort to really make this kind of stuff tangible and to think in historically specific ways about how capital moves and how it becomes fixed in particular social arrangements. So I'm looking at investment more broadly. So I'm moving sort of, I could say, from the world of, you know, sort of fixed investment to more movable investment. Looking at a social and cultural history of mass investment in the 19th and 20th century in France, particularly looking at, you know, sort of progressively how small savers get pulled into the financial market, and really being attentive to France's particular economic modernity, small savers' enthusiasm for finance, which really marked It's a distinctive characteristic of the investment public in this country at the end of the 19th century, and their enthusiasm for international finance. So I'm really interested in how the French people begin to send their money to South Africa, how they send it to Panama, how they send it to, particularly the Ottoman Empire. What kind of work has to go into convincing them that that's a smart thing to do? And what does that mean for someone who lives, you know, sort of often in very isolated places in the middle of France? How did that come to be? What were the mechanisms that sort of brought the market to them and then brought them their money back out into a global economy?
Well, that sounds like an exciting and important project, and I hope you'll keep me posted on its development. Alexi, I just want to thank you so much for speaking with me today and for writing the book.
Thank you very much.